Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Philosophy and Cultural Politics, this week on Soundings. Join me now for conversations with two philosophers, Richard Rorty of the University of Virginia and Thomas Flynn of Emory University. I'll talk first with Richard Rorty about philosophy and the politics of the American left. After that, Thomas Flynn discusses the life and work of Michel Foucault, the French historian who's also a major figure in modern philosophy. We begin with a conversation featuring Richard Rorty. The New York Times Magazine recently described Rorty as the most influential contemporary American philosopher, a reputation stemming in part from his critique of Western liberalism. But Rorty has also been called anti-philosophical, because he endorses traditionally unphilosophical approaches, such as fiction, poetry, and gay and lesbian studies, to provide insights into highbrow as well as popular culture. I asked him to talk about the old left and the new, and to describe the relation of philosophy to politics and culture as he sees them today. Richard Rorty.
Well, there have always been differences between what goes on in the university and what goes on in the rest of society. Universities have always been slightly to the left of society as a whole, but in the past they've been only mildly to the left. They've maintained contact with mainstream left politics, which in the U.S. means the left wing of the Democratic Party. More recently, a new kind of left has grown up in the universities, a pretty far out left, a descendant of the radical left of the 60s. It doesn't take part in street demonstrations much, but it's extremely active within certain university departments, particularly the literature departments and primarily the English department.
Is it true that Marxism is dead except for the English and literature departments of American universities? Is that a joke, or is there a serious side to that?
I think it's almost true, and it's dying even in those departments. It's being replaced by followers of Michel Foucault, who is sort of the Marx after Marx is dead.
Tell me about the relationship between French philosophy, or even more broadly, the rise of theory, and what's going on in our academic departments, particularly with respect to the activities of what we used to call, still call, the left.
Well, in the 50s, under the New Deal and still in the 50s and early 60s, the American left displayed no particular interest in philosophy. It wasn't a Marxist left. It sort of left Marx off as a German thinker whose, pretentiousness wasn't really necessary for political action. Insofar as the American left had a philosophical hero, it was John Dewey. Not that anybody read Dewey with any enormous attention, but that what Dewey said was taken to be pretty much common sense. In the 60s, American intellectuals developed a taste for theory, for deep philosophy, because they began to feel that perhaps the American left was naive by comparison to the lefts in other countries. So there came back a new interest in Marx. Marx led to Hegel. Hegel led to Nietzsche and Heidegger. Heidegger led to Derrida and Foucault. And since Derrida and Foucault were the most recent representatives of a large continental tradition of thought, they became the cutting edge of what we now call theory.
Would you say, Richard Rorty, that there is, again, a necessary connection between the charges, the abuses, the highs and lows of what is called political correctness, and this pattern that you have been describing, this relationship that has evolved between the left in the American academy and the rise of theory, the French philosophers? Am I being too narrow?
There's a connection, but I think there are two independent sources for the kind of horror story which people classify under the heading political correctness. The most important is perhaps simple frustration with national electoral politics, the feeling that there are no left-wing Democratic candidates, or at least none who have the courage to express their real opinions, and that there is no national party or national movement to get behind. This makes academics turn inward toward university politics and makes them set up speech codes, set up compulsory courses, take the kinds of initiatives which result in horror stories. These initiatives are then backed up by rhetoric drawn from people like Derrida and Foucault, but they would probably be taken even if they didn't have the rhetoric.
You've been accused, Dick Rorty, of, is betrayal too strong a word, of betraying the American left? I mean, you come from a respectable tradition of liberal to radical philosophy, writing. And yet here you are criticizing the American left. Do you propose what? A different agenda? Another agenda? Is it true that in fact you are betraying the left?
That's certainly been said. My books are viewed as defenses of the status quo, as insufficiently radical. My response tends to be that the more radical you get, the more your vocabulary for political deliberation loses touch with those of the voters, with your fellow American citizens, and that you don't really want a heavily theorized, heavily philosophized, strange-sounding jargon for politics.
Well, here we come back, what, to pragmatism. And again, I don't want to exaggerate it. You picked the right word. But Dewey, as a pragmatist, is he one of your heroes?
Very much so. I think his liberalism combined with his pragmatic approach to the philosophical tradition is still a perfectly workable theoretical framework for political action by Americans, and perhaps the only theoretical framework we really need.
You've also been accused of being a sort of an anti-philosopher because you question the notion of theory. You question the notion of a gap, a distance between philosophy and real life, for lack of a better term. You endorse items, elements such as narrative. You say, for example, that we can find truth with a small or a little t. In poets, in novels. Again, this large proposition that we call narrative. Tell me about that.
Here again, I think of myself as following Dewey. Dewey once said that philosophy shouldn't be thought of as a super science. It should be thought of a way of reflecting on social conflicts among human communities. This seems to me also a description of much of what we call literature, of a great many novels. I see philosophy not as distinguished by the application of rigorous methods, but as continuous with literature on the one hand and with political action on the other hand.
You have mentioned gay and lesbian studies, African-American studies, women's studies. What about them? Are they? What is their proper and legitimate role? Why do you defend them?
I defend them mainly because I think their existence within the universities, the existence of such disciplines within the universities, has provided needed sanctuaries for groups of people trying to develop a feminist consciousness or a gay and lesbian consciousness. Consciousness is perhaps not the right term. One might speak simply of an ability to feel secure among one's fellows, an ability to have enough self-respect to speak in the name of a previously oppressed group. This seems to me to hold also for people in African American studies programs. These studies have made possible the formation of a much larger African American intelligentsia than we've ever had before.
Well, in a way here, Dick Rorty, what you're doing is defending the proposition of multiculturalism. The accusation has been made that if we take it too far, we balkanize not only the American Academy, but the American society. Why can't we have simply literature, history, philosophy? Why do we have to give it particular names? Or we're headed here for, some people would say, a destructive form of sectarianism. What about that?
I think they have a point. I agree with Arthur Schlesinger's recent book on the subject, by and large. I don't want education to be made compulsorily multicultural, but I am very glad that universities have established these new disciplines, these new centers of study, simply because it brings new kinds of people into the university and gives a kind of intellectual and social respectability to groups that previously didn't have it. And this, to give protection and support to such groups, seems to me one of the functions of the university, which has nothing in particular to do with the curriculum.
What is the public responsibility of a philosopher? Here I'm sitting looking at an article that came out in the New York Times, and there's a sort of romantic, fanciful picture of Richard Rorty off in his mountain cabin, detached from the world and society, and yet, after a fashion, passionately engaged with the problems of everyday men and women. Do you think of yourself as having a responsibility?
I think all intellectuals have a problem about whether what they're best at doing and what they most enjoy doing is going to be of any use to anybody else. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
Welcome to the human race. I mean, yeah. Who is it that doesn't get up and go to work in the morning and say, yeah. what good is it? Am I doing?
Right. And I don't think that intellectuals or philosophers are, much different from most people in this respect. And I think it's a disaster if they get all self-conscious about it and say, gee, am I doing the right thing? Am I being sufficiently responsible? Am I responding to the needs of my society? If they do what they're good at, what fascinates them, what they love, they have a reasonable chance of somewhere or sometime being of some use.
Uh-huh. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Richard Rorty. No less than Harold Bloom, himself a very prominent cultural commentator, has called you probably the most exciting philosopher in the United States, if not the entire world. Does that mean that you think about things like truth and beauty and virtue and connect them to the way, again, everyday men and women lead their lives?
It would be more accurate to say I think about what previous philosophers have said about truth, virtue, and beauty. They've said a lot of different contradictory things. And like most other contemporary philosophers, what I spend my time on is picking apart what they have said and putting it back together in new ways.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Richard Rorty. What's your responsibility to undergraduate education? When you walk into the classroom and you engage your mind with the minds of these kids who come and sit and say, well, I'm being trained to think, and I'm learning how to live. Is that what goes on in a philosophy classroom?
That's what the kids come in thinking, and I try to discourage this kind of attitude and suggest all I can do is make you acquainted with certain very interesting figures whom you might or might not take a shine to. And if you read enough Plato or Nietzsche or Hegel, this text might become important in your life, and this person's thought might mean something to you. Whether it does or not is up for grabs.
Richard Rorty, I appreciate your participation on Soundings. It's a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center. Thank you for coming by, and good luck with your work.
Thanks very much, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Philosophy and Cultural Politics, this week on Soundings. Join me now for a conversation about the life and work of Michel Foucault, the controversial French historian who's also one of the major figures in modern philosophy. I'll talk with Thomas Flynn of Emory University. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Tom Flynn is working on a comparative study of Michel Foucault and Jean-Paul Sartre. To his critics, Foucault is a destroyer of traditional philosophical notions of an ordered universe. But according to Tom Flynn, Michel Foucault is important to modern philosophy and historical studies because he believed that one person's notion of universal order was another person's idea of domination and control. Power relations are all pervasive, indeed unavoidable. You can't escape authority, Foucault says, but you can be on guard against its abuse. Tom Flynn attended the last lectures delivered by Michel Foucault before the philosopher's death in 1984. I asked him to recall that time.
Well, Wayne, it was quite an experience, given in retrospect, of course, his death a few months later. Foucault lectured in the hall that the philosopher Henri Bergson had lectured in at the Collège de France, and it was packed with people. He had, of course, quite a reputation as perhaps the leading intellectual in France at the time. So there were a lot of intellectual groupies who gathered around him, and the usual people who would go to these public lectures as they were at the Collège de France. He began 3 weeks late, and I remember sitting in the front row. Monsieur le Prof came in the door, sat down, began to look at his notes, and without addressing the people directly in his eyes, said, I apologize to you for the fact that I'm 3 weeks late. And then, as if to answer the skeptical thoughts of those people used to professorial ploys, he paused, looked up at the audience, and said, I really was. Well, you know, for those of us who realized that, in retrospect, that the man was going to die in four months or so, and that he had AIDS, for him, his sang-froid, you know, his kind of stoic resignation, if you will, to all of this, was really quite admirable, because the topic he was dealing with that particular term was truth-telling, le franc-parler, plain speaking, among the people whom he admired quite a bit, despite their limitations, the so-called good cynics. And Foucault himself, in a way, that was kind of a homecoming for him, going back to ancient Greek thought.
You've put a lot of issues on the table here in front of us, Tom Flynn. Let's see if we can unpack a few of them. Here's a man, Foucault, who is vilified and praised. I don't know if we would say in equal measures, but he is certainly the object of strong personal and academic intellectual expression.
No doubt.
Why is that? I mean, give me a sense of what this man was as a philosopher, and then we'll get to some of these other issues.
Well, I think he was a gadfly, for one thing, and gadflies are not very popular beings. I mean, Socrates, after all, set the tone of the philosopher who told the truth in a way, and did so maybe imprudently, and paid for it with his life. Foucault was that's why I think he admired the so-called good cynics, the plain speakers, because he told it like he saw it. Mm-hmm. He was a kaleidoscopic thinker. That is, he turned if you will, the kaleidoscope of our thought, of our received opinions and necessities, just a little bit, in order for the entire configuration to change.
Would you call him a public philosopher? Would you say that philosophers typically in the 20th century are academicians? I mean, no disrespect to you when I say that they live in ivory towers. That's at least the reputation.
That's right.
Here, apparently, is a man who was not off by himself, who engaged public issues. What about that?
Well, you know, being a philosopher in France, especially in Paris, where the intellectual life is terrifically incestuous, everyone went to school together, they live down the street from each other, and when they have a battle, it's in the newspapers. You can't really live in the ivory tower. Everyone knows you, and you write to the newspapers. You may even have a column in the newspapers, as some philosophers have done over the years, Raymond Aron, for example. So Foucault was an engaged, if you will, or committed philosopher, as Sartre was, of course, and gave the term, in fact, to that notion. But he was also what the French call a rat bibliothécaire. That is, he was a library rat, if you will. Mm-hmm. He spent a great deal of time in the Bibliothèque Nationale. Go ahead.
What engaged him? I mean, give me a specific sense here, Tom Flynn, of the kinds of issues that he worried about and thought about as a philosopher.
It's interesting, you know, because as a philosopher, here's an identity problem. He was an archivist in a technical sense of that word. He was, in other words, the question one must ask with regard to Michel Foucault was he a philosopher or was he an historian? I would say this, that, you know, the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead once said that philosophy in the West is mainly a series of footnotes to Plato. Well, Foucault, if anything, was profoundly anti-Platonic. And from that point of view, he could be seen anti-philosophical.
All right. Now, this means that he did not believe in... we're going to go back to the undergraduate terms that we all acquired. He did not believe, what, in an ideal world, a world out beyond what we see in the practical world?
Cosmos, that's right.
Unpack that for
that's
me.
That's right. Well, you know, the Greek ideal of a cosmos, of an ordered universe where reason rules, and the job of the philosopher is to uncover that reason, to let it shine forth. if you will, that's the ideal, the Platonic Aristotelian ideal that has been the standard for philosophy in the West.
Well, what did he believe in? Is belief the right word to use?
Well, one might want to say belief. In fact, an act of will, a commitment, perhaps simply a questioning of received convictions. I think that is something he shares with a lot of philosophers, even, if you will, the granddaddy of them all, Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
But Socrates, you know, was accused of being a sophist. We go back to the accusation of sophistry. He was accused of being a sophist, and one could argue, in fact, was executed for that conviction that he was.
That is to say, hiding behind a camouflage, a ruse of words that are essentially meaningless, that really have no core to them, that do not go to these profoundly spiritual issues of belief and behavior.
Or you might say trying to replace intellectual insight with personal conviction of some sort. Mm-hmm. In other words, trying to appeal not to the true in the classical sense of the word, the way things are in themselves, but to the good, namely what you think is desirable.
Is the true here the social and the personal, the idiosyncratic, and therefore untrustworthy? Is that the problem?
In the classical distinction, one could say that's the case. What Foucault is doing is basically saying, and we'll go, I want to return to the sophist, the accusation of sophistry, he's saying that the sophists received a bad press, that they, in a sense, are the victims of a Platonic prejudice that has been with us ever since. Foucault, of course, has been a defender of marginal thinkers all along, including himself. And the good cynics that I spoke of before, whom he was addressing in his last lectures, would be an example of this as well. These are people who didn't say that you are wrong in the sense that you're committed to an ultimate truth and there ain't no such thing, if you will. That would be a little bit too much hubris. What they're saying is that it's possible that you're mistaken and that there seem to be a plurality of truths. And one should address more limited issues, not grandiose over master issues with large narratives and so forth.
Let me look at you utterly wide-eyed here, Tom Flynn. Did Michel Foucault believe in God? I mean, is that the kind of issue that's important to is that the kind of question that's important to put to an important philosopher like this? Or does that really miss the point of what he is as a philosopher?
Well, good question. Let's go back to the kaleidoscope model. In a way, I think what Foucault would say is this, that the God question is important given a certain configuration of the universe, of explanations of the universe. But let's move that whole collection of thoughts a little bit, that grid, if you will, that makes the universe intelligible to us. Let's move it a little bit and see if the question is not exactly answered, but disappears. And I think that would be his move. The move, and which some people find frustrating, it's perhaps an end run, if you want to use the metaphor of football.
Well, if God disappears, you make me think of that famous Time magazine cover in black and white. Is God dead? Is that the kind of thing that he's asking? Is that at the heart of his project as a philosopher?
Well, a lot of people want to read that into his project, mainly because, of course, the philosopher of the death of God, Friedrich Nietzsche, is someone who has had immense influence on these contemporary French thinkers, including Foucault. Foucault admired Nietzsche a great deal. But, you know, the issue really was not so much the death of God as the subsequent death of man, which, of course, many of Nietzsche's critics foretold, and I think was really quite true. What Foucault wants to do is to, in a sense, structure that those deaths, if you will. He wants to show that when you change the kaleidoscope a little bit, you find that the question of God doesn't have the centrality it once did, but correspondingly neither does the question of man.
Again, let me pursue a personal angle here, Tom Flynn. You're working on Michel Foucault, the French philosopher, the intensely personal. Here at the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned that this is a man who died of AIDS. Is it important that we understand his personal life, his personal conduct, in order to make sense of his philosophy? Where does the one stop and the other begin?
Well, that's a question I think that many people will ask. He himself deliberately avoided those kinds of questions in the many, many interviews that he gave. He seldom addressed this matter, and when it was raised, particularly in the context of his intellectual position, he simply dismissed it as irrelevant. So from that point of view, I could say, well, no, it isn't a relevant issue. But of course, for so many people, it is a very relevant issue. What kind of a person was he? Did his suspicion of the abuse of power and so forth, or his preference for or defense of marginal people, was it not the expression of his own marginalized position as a homosexual?
Do you find yourself defending this man before your undergraduate or graduate students at Emory? Again, is that an irrelevancy?
Well, no, it's not an irrelevancy. I think any philosophical, any philosopher, or let's say professor of philosophy, is going to try to present the thinker in as sympathetic a mode as possible. Just as when you're teaching a foreign language, you don't start by teaching the exceptions. You teach the rules first, and then you get into the exceptions. Otherwise, they don't learn the rules. But once the student has appreciated what the thinker is about, then, or at least in the process, you can begin to raise some problems about limitations. You implied that there was going to be a question about the adequacy of Foucault's approach to, say, current political debate, and that's a quite legitimate question. Foucault didn't want to give ultimate answers or final answers. He was a voice in a conversation. I think that's important to keep that in mind. He was very suspicious of thinkers who thought in large terms, all the answers, or the answer, the purpose of history, or the meaning of history, and so forth. He was a divider, and not a unifier. He was in favor of multiplicity and plurality, in defense of freedom, I would say, of individual freedom. I do respect his courage. I respect his questioning, inquisitive mind. After all, that's one of the points of being a philosopher, isn't it?
Tom Flynn, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. You are a professor in the philosophy department at Emory University, and you're spending the year here with us working on Michel Foucault. I wish you well in your work.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations about philosophy, politics, and culture. The speakers were Richard Rorty of the University of Virginia and Thomas Flynn of Emory University. If you'd like a cassette copy of their discussions, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 600. That's program number 600, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, listen for a conversation featuring Richard Bushman, a professor of history at Columbia University. Our topic will be Richard Bushman's book, Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Philosophy and the Politics of Culture, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Richard Rorty of the University of Virginia in a discussion about philosophy and the politics of the American left. Thomas Flynn of Emory University discusses the life and work of the influential modern French historian Michel Foucault. Philosophy and the Politics of Culture. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.